final investigator interviewed for this program was Dr. Alex Sekulich, who began our conversation by presenting a patient from his practice.
So the patient is a 63-year-old white male who presented with 8-year history of slowly growing destructive lesion that was involving his forehead and progressed to involve his eye. The tumor progression and swelling of the tissues finally led to the left eye swelling and closure of the eyelid, which prompted him to seek medical attention.
Could I just ask, was he in some kind of social situation that he couldn't access care?
Yes, he was. So he was actually a person with a regular job, but over time he lost his job and actually became homeless. So the patient, as I said, developed the swelling of the eye, which prompted him finally to seek medical attention. At time of presentation, his imaging by MRI identified tumor that was involving the forehead, extending inferiorly into the left orbit, as well as immediately to involve the left frontal sinus, anterior wall, and left medial nasal bridge.
Could I just ask, did you see him at that time?
This is a description when I saw him, yes.
Before we get into sort of the medical aspects, what was his state of mind? I mean, he had been concerned about this or not concerned about it?
Of course, of course. And this is a question that will come often about patients with advanced basal cell carcinomas. Is this a neglect purely, or is this aggressive disease? And it appears that there is both. In some patients, it's going to be neglect, and in some patients, it's going to be just aggressive disease.
Any estimate nationwide, for example, in the United States, you know, how many patients a year present with this type of locally advanced problem?
It is a rare problem. Vast majority of basal cell carcinomas are seen early, operated, and cleared early. And there are no good statistics of how many of these patients are seen. The current phase 2 clinical trial that accrued within 12 months has accrued actually in a short period of time, and that is a study of 100 patients.
So just out of curiosity, about how many patients like this a year do you see?
Again, it's variable, and we have all noticed that when patients actually know about potential treatment, they are identified. Often, we see that patients that have actually basal cell carcinoma, especially metastatic disease, have not been diagnosed with basal cell carcinomas, as it is thought not to be possible or not to exist.
Metastatic, that sort of sounds a little unusual. How often does that happen, and where does it go?
So it is very rare, and if you look at the literature, there's a debate about the frequency, which is way below 0.1%, I would say. But frequently it goes to the lungs, but it can be seen in other organs, especially locally parotid and things like that.
So when you have a situation of, quote, advanced basal cell, I guess presumably it's going to be locally, is that usually clinically a scenario like this man primarily presenting that way, or do you see that in people who are treated and keep having recurrences that can't be stopped?
Both. There are patients, like a patient I saw recently, a young woman who has had basal cell carcinoma on the face, which was treated surgically but has recurred and then subsequently treated by radiation. She now has recurrence of basal cell carcinoma in the radiation field after another surgery. So this kind of a high-risk basal cell carcinoma, which obviously not due to neglect, is seen.
I was going to ask you about radiation therapy in general. How radiosensitive or resistant is it? And what about in this man?
So the radiation therapy is one of the modalities that has been used historically for basal cell carcinoma of the advanced type or in situations where for other reasons surgery was not thought to be a good option. Many basal cell carcinomas will respond to radiotherapy, but if we are dealing with a large basal cell carcinoma and where radiotherapy may be affecting other surrounding normal structures, or in cases where radiotherapy is completely contraindicated, such as people with basal cell nevus syndrome, in those cases, radiation therapy is not an option.
And what kinds of local problems can you get into? I mean, I would guess, you know, bleeding, pain, and infection, but practically speaking, what about this man?
So in somebody like this and other similar cases, one has a very destructive tumor which is progressing to take over the eye, so loss of vision, loss of vital organs. So local destruction by default is local, but depending on to which extent progresses, it will have different degrees of severity.
Now, to what extent is basal cell sun-related, and where is the distribution of appearance?
That is a very good question. Basal cell carcinoma is one of the three common skin cancers, including squamous cell carcinoma, basal, and melanoma. By far, basal cell carcinoma is the most common of those, and there are current estimates that non-melanoma skin cancers, including basal and squamous, have frequency that is significantly higher than previously thought, probably over 3 million in this country per year. But to answer the question about distribution, it does develop primarily on sun-exposed areas. There is some difference in terms of the type of sun exposure that is associated with development of individual skin cancers, such that squamous cell carcinoma appears to have much more of a linear correlation with cumulative exposure, whereas on the other end of the spectrum, melanoma seems to correlate more with early exposure, early in life, high-level exposure such as sunburns. Basal cell carcinoma seems to have components of both. There's some early component to it, but also cumulative component.
What do we know about the number of deaths per year, say the United States, from basal cell and for that matter, squamous cell?
Majority of the deaths in non-melanoma skin cancer group are attributable to squamous cell carcinoma in the order of 1,000 to 2,000 deaths per year. So relatively low number given the number of cases.
Actually, it sounds like a lot.
Well, it is a lot, but when you think about the few million cases total per year, that is a relatively low percentage. Again, illustrating that these days, majority of these cases are recognized early and treated surgically.
And again, number of deaths from basal cell?
That is very difficult to estimate, as it's related to the same question we discussed earlier, which is the frequency of metastatic basal cell carcinoma.
So people generally don't die of just local disease?
Generally, people don't die of just local disease, but in many cases, the local disease ultimately, if untreated, may progress to the metastatic disease, as case in point with the gentleman I described earlier, who also had numerous pulmonary nodules.
Is that the same man you're talking about?
Yes.
So this man with the very locally advanced disease had pulmonary mets?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Any other site of metastatic disease?
No.
So he was presenting with locally advanced and metastatic basal cell.
He presented, yes, with locally advanced, which led to, of course, staging and identification of pulmonary metastases.
Again, just sort of flipping back to him as a person, you know, you mentioned that he was homeless, but was he involved with his care, interested in information, or was, you know, what was his state of mind?
Yes, very much so, very much so. And since he started actually his care, his social situation improved as well. Whether that's a reflection of the care or just concurrent event, difficult to say.
So what options might be considered for a patient like this, both on and off study right now? Not just in your place, but nationwide.
So this patient actually was offered surgical excision at his local center, with the understanding that the surgical excision will remove half of his face, his eye, and potentially the other eye to which the tumor was advancing, and that there was a little chance that he would actually get full control of the disease with a single surgery.
Could I just ask, why was surgery offered if he had mets?
That was offered to him prior to presenting to our center, offered based on the clinical presentation.
So they didn't know he had mets?
They did not know that he had mets yet.
Could I just ask, I mean, if he didn't have mets, for example, would surgery have been an option from your point of view or even with the mets?
I don't think so, because with this type of disease and with this extent of disease, it is highly unlikely that the surgical resection would obtain clear margins. And we know that the obtaining clear margins is the paramount when treating basal cell carcinoma to prevent recurrence.
How about radiation therapy?
So radiation therapy is another option. He was actually evaluated by radiation oncology, but given the proximity of other structures, radiation therapy was not thought to be the adequate curative option.
Was he having pain, and could you see this tumor visibly?
Oh, yes.
So it was an erosive tumor?
A large ulcerated tumor involving the orbit, leading to a swelling of the orbit and eyelids and closure of the structures.
It sounds like it must have been uncomfortable or painful.
Surprisingly, not too painful. He was more disturbed by the visual appearance at that point when his eye was shut rather than by the pain itself.
Wow. Does he have a family?
He has a family, although no family in his immediate surroundings.
So again, in addition to surgery and radiation therapy, what about systemic therapy, both non-research alternatives as well as clinical trials out there?
there is really no standard of care for these patients. There are anecdotal reports, case reports of patients treated with various types of chemotherapies with varying responses. So really there is no standard of care that one could go to.
What about trial options?
The trial options at this point include targeted inhibitors of so-called hedgehog signaling pathway. And this is actually a very exciting area of progress in translational research over the last decade, as it illustrates actually the true bench-to-bedside transition, where a pathway was identified that is involved in virtually all basal cell carcinomas, and a drug developed to specifically target the member of that pathway called smoothened.
And could you talk a little more at a very basic level in terms of sort of what the hedgehog pathway is and what kind of agents or agent are available to inhibit it?
Yeah, this is actually a very interesting story. It started actually with a series of events where cyclopic sheep were born in Western United States. And after years of actually attempting to identify what may have caused this, it turned out that these pregnant ewes were ingesting a corn lily plant, which at a certain time of the year was containing a compound called cyclopamine, named after the teratogenic effect that it induced. Well, cyclopamine turned to be an inhibitor of a smoothened, which is a member of hedgehog signaling pathway. Concurrent work in fruit flies that elucidated this pathway and identification of the pathway activity in basal cell carcinoma led to the efforts to attempt to use cyclopamine for treatment by inhibiting the hedgehog signaling pathway. Synthetic analogs of cyclopamine are now being developed, the most advanced of which is GDC-0449, now known as vismodegib. And this is a compound that is currently in clinical trials, in phase 2 clinical trials.
So the native compound, cyclopamine, is it a protein or what is it?
That's an alkaloid that is actually identified in the extract of the West corn lily. And as I said, the molecule inhibits smoothened, which is the active member of the hedgehog signaling pathway. The pathway actually relies on the smoothened, which is the active protein, which is normally repressed by a protein called patched. Patched, when it's not inhibiting smoothened, smoothened will act and induce proliferation of the cells. It's interesting that in basal cell Nevus syndrome or Gorlin-Golz syndrome, patients have mutations or loss of patched gene, thus losing the repression of the smoothened and resulting continual activity and proliferation of the cells.
Is there some more global function, you know, where these pathways fit in the cell?
Yes. So these pathways are important in development, and that is the reason why their inhibition of this pathway in sheep was teratogenic. And also, this pathway seems to play an important role in so-called stem cell compartments of some tissues, such as some of the epithelial tissues, hair follicles, and so on. Some of the early side effects of the therapy noticed in phase 1 clinical trial of targeted smoothened inhibitors also illustrate this, as patients do have hair loss as one of the side effects. The side effects that were seen in phase 1 trial and published in the New England Journal of Medicine in late 2009 do include several effects, including hair loss, taste alterations, muscle cramping in some patients, weight loss in some patients, which may or may not be secondary to taste alterations.
This is oral and given daily?
Oral, given daily.
And what's been observed in terms of responses?
So in the phase 1 trial, which was initially set up to accommodate patients with various advanced cancers, the drastic responses were seen in basal cell carcinoma patients, leading to an expansion cohort of 33 patients accrued to that study. 18 of those 33 had objective responses, 11 had stable disease, and 4 progressive disease.
Any complete responses?
2 complete responses out of 18 responders.
And what about duration of response?
That is something that is still not clear. And some of these patients, the responses continued for numerous months, actually a couple of years. So that is a very interesting question that will have to be answered long term, whether a therapy will need to be given long term or not.
So have there been patients who, for example, responded and then progressed, and have those tumors been looked at to see what's going on?
That is currently being done, but there is no data out yet. Actually, let me just back up here. That has been done, and there is data in a related tumor, which is medulloblastoma. And as you know, patients with Gorlin syndrome or basal cell nevus syndrome are at higher risk of developing medulloblastomas. And one of the patients that was included in that phase one trial has had a good response and then rapidly developed resistance. Sequencing of the smoothing gene at that time identified a mutation that made the protein resistant to GDC0449 inhibition.
Medulloblastoma. So what is the spectrum of tumors, you know, in addition to basal cell, where theoretically, I'm assuming medulloblastoma, there's some translational work that suggests it would respond?
Well, so medulloblastoma is known to occur in patients with basal cell nevus syndrome, where there is germline loss or mutation, dysfunction of the patched gene in the hedgehog signaling pathway.
Huh.
So both tumors would fall into a group of tumors where internal hedgehog signaling pathway plays an important role in driving the tumor. A lot of work has been done recently in evaluating other tumors, including colon cancer, ovarian cancer, and others, studying the interaction of the tumor with the environment or stroma around tumor cells, where two-way communication that is based on hedgehog signaling pathway may be occurring. And several trials are attempting to address that question, whether hedgehog inhibition in any of those cancers may have utility.
So have there been clinical studies, I think there have, of hedgehog inhibitors, I don't know about this one, in other tumors?
Yes, as I mentioned, so there are several tumors, including ovarian and colorectal, where this has been attempted. There are no positive findings from these studies so far. At present, we have evidence that the inhibition of the pathway is very effective in basal cell carcinoma, but not for other cancers yet.
So I'm just kind of looking at this new name, Vismodegib. I mean, that's not the sort of TKI type name, right?
No, because it actually describes a novel class of drugs.
Because it's got an unusual ending. Is that for this class?
Exactly. Exactly.
Huh, I've never heard of it.
Well, it's the first name for this class. You know, the nomenclature will probably follow in other drugs that are being developed currently for the same purpose.
That's fascinating. So have there been any other agents where objective responses or even that have been studied in humans?
For basal cell carcinoma?
Well, yeah, hedgehog inhibitors.
Yeah, so there are a couple other hedgehog inhibitors, but they are not quite as advanced in development as the Vismodegib. So there was a topical formulation of LDE-225, I believe, which was evaluated but has not produced a positive effect so far.
I'm always looking for nicknames. We just had brentuximab vedotin that we had to shorten down to B-vedotin. Does this one go by like Vismo or anything?
Exactly. So people are starting to refer it as Vismo. Although I have to say, this name was actually announced a few weeks ago.
Vismo. Okay. So you mentioned the phase one study of this agent. What other trials are out there right now?
So currently there is a trial, phase two trial, that has accrued. And the goal of that trial is to evaluate the overall response rates in patients with locally advanced or metastatic BCC, similar population to that one that was studied in the phase one study of this agent. In addition, there is a trial that is looking at operable basal cell carcinomas, looking at a shorter treatment of 3 months in one cohort, compared to the cohort where the patients are treated for 3 months and then observed for 6 months. At the end of the 3 month treatment in cohort one and at the end of the treatment plus observation period in the second cohort, the original tumor is removed. Question being asked is there clearance of the tumor and what is the durability of the response after the drug is removed?
Very interesting. So kind of like I'm thinking, you know, the analogy to other cancers would be neoadjuvant treatment. I mean, would there be potentially a therapeutic role in addition to the translational information?
That is a very intriguing possibility. If one looks at the data from the published phase one clinical trial, the reduction in the size of the tumor may well lend the tumor to resection in cases where resection was not thought to be possible initially.
You know, it's kind of interesting. You think about it. What does it take to have an agent, you know, become available? When do you think this agent might be available? And I mean, how much data do you need when you see responses in a disease that doesn't have any alternatives?
That is a very hot question, as we all know, in oncology, as we are shifting from the unselected tumor populations and general chemotherapy type of drugs to selected targeted agents in smaller populations.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about squamous cell cancer, and you have a patient to present.
So, a 67-year-old white male who is status post kidney transplant 6 years ago on immunosuppression, including cyclosporine, has presented with a history of rapid increase in number of non-melanoma skin cancers, predominantly squamous cell carcinomas and predominantly on his head and neck area. So at the presentation, patient had several nodules which were biopsied, and several of them actually demonstrated high-grade infiltrative squamous cell carcinoma histology, so a more aggressive type of local disease.
Can you talk a little bit about the risk of squamous cell in patients on immune suppressive therapy?
So immunosuppression overall is estimated to increase incidence for squamous cell carcinoma over 60-fold. This also translates into basal cell carcinomas and melanomas, although at lower rate. It's estimated that probably about 5% of patients on systemic immunosuppression for organ transplants will develop skin cancer in the first 5 years and about 10% in the first 10 years. Not only that the incidence is higher, but also the risk for metastases of the squamous cell carcinomas that do develop is increased several fold.
So just to flip that back then, of the 1,000 or 2,000 people dying of the disease, how many of them are associated with immune suppressive therapy?
Difficult to say, and I think why it's difficult is because it's a moving target. We have had a significant increase in number of transplanted patients, systemically immunosuppressed patients, over the last couple of decades.
So when was this patient seen at that point? When was that?
The patient presented, as I said, 6 years into his immunosuppression when he noticed rapid increase of these nodules on his head. And at presentation, several of those were biopsied and several of them actually demonstrated higher risk histology. So the patient had no evidence of other disease. He continued developing new nodules and has had several subsequent Mohs micrographic surgeries, which aim to identify the margin, histologic margin of the cancer and remove it in its entirety. However, within a year, patient developed a regional metastatic disease. It was in the neck lymph nodes, and he was treated with neck dissection and adjuvant radiation therapy. The chemotherapy was considered at the time cisplatin, as platinum agents have historically been used in this patient population. But due to his oral health and the history of AGA nephropathy, he was started on bleomycin. Patient actually progressed very quickly, even on therapy, and developed declining mental status and passed away. An important issue in this patient that this patient's history illustrates is that immunosuppression does increase significantly risk for development of skin cancer, squamous cell carcinoma. It significantly increases the risk for more aggressive disease once it's developed. Also, it raises questions about immunosuppression. A lot of discussion over the last couple of years has been going on in terms of level of immunosuppression, whether decreasing the level of immunosuppression may prevent some of these cancers, and whether type of immunosuppression, in particular drugs that are used to immunosuppress patients, may also help with this. And some preclinical data suggests that there may be differences in immunosuppressants, such as cyclosporine versus, for example, rapamycin, rapamune, not only in the mode of immunosuppression, but also other effects that may influence the growth of cancers. Cyclosporine, again, in preclinical arena, has been shown to actually be pro-angiogenic, whereas rapamycin or derivatives of rapamycin seems to be anti-angiogenic, and angiogenesis is an important property for tumor progression.
Any speculations about sort of the translational connection, specifically in terms of immune suppression and squamous cell, in terms of kind of the pathophysiology or biology of what actually is going on? Is there an immune pathway that theoretically maybe would explain this?
This is also a very active area of research. And as you can imagine, there are several possibilities, although there are no final answers. One of the possibilities that is being tested and evaluated is lack in immunosurveillance. In other words, immune system, once inhibited, is not recognizing skin cancers that it should recognize. The other possibility, also a very hot area of research, is are these patients, due to immunosuppression, more susceptible to infections, particularly viral infections, as we know that viruses do play a role in cancer, and numerous strains of HPV have been demonstrated, particularly in skin cancers, and whether that is the primary event that increases the risk for skin cancer and for aggressive form of skin cancer.
So you mentioned the platinums, and in general, outside a protocol setting, do oncologists just sort of approach this like it's squamous cell somewhere else and use chemo agents?
Yeah, the older types of treatments that have been done are not based on rigorous trials. So most of this is anecdotal rather than well-documented. But platinum-based therapies such as cisplatin were probably among the most commonly historically used therapies. There are other therapies that are of a more recent date, such as cetuximab, antibody that targets EGF receptor, which was studied in a relatively small phase 2 trial demonstrating objective response rate of 32% in patients with metastatic squamous cell carcinoma of the skin.
By itself, did you say?
Yes.
That sounds sort of encouraging.
Yes, yes. Preliminary data, small numbers of patients, so it's difficult to extrapolate how reliable this will be long term. But again, it offers a glimmer of hope. And also, it pushes, I guess, squamous cell carcinoma slowly to a more targeted therapy era, which we are seeing now in basal cell carcinoma and in melanoma.
So are there any VISMOs out there for squamous cell or any trials looking at targeted agents?
Unlike basal cell carcinoma and melanoma, where we are able to identify larger segments of patient population with specific molecular defects that may be targetable, in squamous cell carcinoma, so far, we do not have targetable defects for which drugs have been developed so far.
So let's talk a little bit about melanoma, and I'm more interested from your perspective as a dermatologist. Maybe you can present the case you were telling me about.
So this case is an unusual case and illustrates actually the heterogeneity that one sees with melanoma patients, which never seems to amaze. It's a 74-year-old woman who actually has had a diagnosis of CLL, and she developed rapidly 5 mole-like lesions on her scalp. Her primary dermatologist biopsied all 5 lesions that developed within a few months, and all 5 were diagnosed as primary melanomas. Highly unusual to have multiple primary melanomas at the same time. Even further, over the ensuing 2 years, patient continued developing small macules that looked like benign nevi or potentially early melanomas. And virtually all of those were biopsied and by histology interpreted by several large dermatopathology laboratories around the country as primary melanomas.
Just out of curiosity, what kind of CLL treatment, if any, was she getting?
She was not getting any CLL treatment because her disease has not progressed to that point yet. But this illustrates the difficulty that one sometimes faces in certain melanoma patients due to unusual presentation. Patient was evaluated at tumor boards on numerous occasions, and continued staging was performed to ensure that there is no other disease that may be linked to this. And for 2 years, there was no evidence of anything else. As such, patient did not fit into any standard protocol for treatments. It wasn't until 2 years later that she developed a small lesion that was diagnosed by recurrent imaging in her liver. The issue with this patient, of course, was that she also had a concurrent diagnosis of CLL, making her ineligible for many trials.
Her liver was biopsied?
Their liver was biopsied, and it was diagnosed as a melanoma. At that point, the assumption was made that all the cutaneous lesions that were seen over 2 years must have represented a metastatic disease, which again, on histology, was indistinguishable from primary. And we do know of the phenomenon that is called epidermotropic metastases, where melanoma in some patients has a very strong propensity to actually be associated with epidermis, epidermal structure, so epidermis of the skin.
So I'm just trying to process this a little bit. Mets, melanoma, metastasis to the skin. And any thoughts about where the primary was?
So we don't know where the primary was because there was no history of a primary disease that preceded this period of small dark macules appearing on various parts of her skin. The only other disease, as I said, that was found was the disease in the liver.
So can you bring us up to date with this woman?
So she was treated with temozolomide, followed by an approach that, again, is something that was anecdotally used in the past, and this is a GM-CSF, Spittler regimen of GM-CSF with 2 weeks off, 2 weeks on, in combination with topical imiquimod, toll-like receptor 7 agonist, the idea being that one is attempting to boost the immune system by treating these topical lesions. That treatment actually is the treatment that preceded the further experimental chemotherapy. She did get into one trial, which was a trial of an experimental hypoxia-activated drug in combination with docetaxel. But even though she had a very short-lived response, she has not benefited significantly from this and, in fact, has quickly progressed, developing numerous mets, including ocular mets, further excluding her from potential trials. The interesting point in this patient is that she did harbor BRAF activating mutation, but given her overall medical situation and history with CLL and progression of the disease, she was not eligible for those trials. Another reason why I bring this patient up is in melanoma, a lot has been learned from genomic analysis of melanoma tissues over the last decade, classifying individual melanomas into subgroups that may require different targeted therapeutic approaches. In this case, the original question was, is this a metastatic disease or concurrent primary tumors that were occurring? And if one thinks of metastatic disease as a clonal process that's disseminating, one thinks of any options that one could look at multiple lesions and identify whether they are clonally related or not. Retrospectively, we have actually developed an approach that allowed us to analyze genomically tissues from this patient. An analysis of several skin tissues at the time when no metastatic disease was seen internally does indicate that all these lesions were clonally related, suggesting that they originated from the same clone for which we did not have a location.
That's fascinating. Getting back to BRAF, though, first of all, do you consider that an assay for BRAF is kind of part of the standard evaluation of anybody with metastatic melanoma?
Absolutely. I think as these therapies move through regulatory processes and get approved, which is highly likely, it will be essential to match the patient or patient's tumor characteristics on molecular level with the therapy. And we can learn about some of this even from early trials in melanoma, where sorafenib, another inhibitor which also inhibits BRAF, was used in unselected populations without much benefit. There are other issues why this may have been the case, but we are realizing that one has to carefully select patients, and those that are likely to respond are those that have the target for the therapeutic option that we are considering.
Now, is the assay sort of easy to use or difficult, like some of the ones, for example, in HER2 and breast cancer, we have all these issues, and is it easily available?
Yes, the assay is available by several commercial vendors, and basically the assay, the ease comes from the fact that this therapy is targeted to BRAF, which seems to be, in vast majority of cases, mutated at the very same spot, allowing very quick sequencing reaction or other types of reactions that identify a specific mutation.
Now, you know, kind of in retrospect, I mean, this woman died. I mean, maybe there's some trial, you know, limitations of accessing a trial, but from a patient care point of view, would you have liked to see her receive a BRAF inhibitor?
Definitely. It is unfortunate that she developed the disease and progressed at the time when this has not been fully tested and yet approved. I would be shocked if a physician taking care of a patient like this, knowing that the patient has a BRAF mutation, would not use BRAF inhibitors if available.
Anything else you want to say about melanoma that we haven't talked about?
I think it is also important to keep in mind that melanoma, like many other cancers, is not one disease. What we call melanoma is a heterogeneous group of disorders, and one can recognize now, even on a molecular level, in addition to clinical presentation, that there are significant differences between melanoma of the eye, ocular melanoma, and melanoma of the skin or mucous membranes. Further, one can also see on a molecular level clear differences between the melanoma of the skin versus melanoma of the mucous membranes. And even on the skin, it appears that there are significant differences in terms of molecular makeup for melanomas that occur on chronically exposed skin, from those that occur on intermittently, occasionally exposed skin, and those that occur on non-exposed skin, such as acral surfaces. For example, melanoma on the BRAF mutations are most commonly found in melanomas on the intermittently exposed skin, but not those originating in areas of non-sun exposed skin, such as acral, or mucosal surfaces. Conversely, c-KIT alterations are seen in about a third of patients with acral melanoma, with mucosal melanoma, but not really in cutaneous melanoma otherwise. And that highlights the importance of, again, recognizing the molecular makeup, identifying the target, and matching the potential treatment with the target that's present.
So what kind of matching up has been done for the c-KIT-positive tumors?
So this is, again, a story that started with unselected patient populations, and treatment of unselected patient populations did not show any evidence of activity.
This was what, imatinib?
Yes. Exactly. And now the trials are ongoing where patients are specifically selected for c-KIT mutations or amplifications to be placed on treatment with imatinib, and those trials are ongoing.
Have any objective responses been observed?
Yes, although the data is preliminary, so I don't think we have a clear final data. But again, I think the important thing is that we are seeing the shift, again, from non-selected populations, where if one tests a potentially effective agent, it is likely that the agent may be discarded as ineffective due to application to non-selected population.
This concept of, you know, multiple biologic subtypes of melanoma, I mean, I don't know, it kind of made me think a little bit about breast cancer, you know, luminal A, B, and all that stuff. How many subtypes do you think there are of melanoma, a few or hundreds?
Again, our current state of knowledge is based on genomic analysis of, relatively speaking, small number of melanomas. But from that analysis that's available so far, we do see that at least two cutaneous types of melanoma on molecular level exist, and not to count in mucosal melanoma and then, of course, separately ocular melanoma. It is likely that we will find other subtypes, as it's often seen in many diseases. The question is just how long it will take for us to actually recognize those less common subtypes.
I'm just kind of curious, what kind of clinical practice do you have? How often do you see patients, and what kinds of patients?
So personally, I see patients in dermatology, and a large number of patients are focused on cutaneous oncology, but I do see general dermatology. And over the last, say, year, my practice has been seeing patients actively between 2.5 and 4 days per week. We do have a very well-coordinated cutaneous oncology group that includes not only dermatologists, but dermatopathologists, pathologists, radiation oncologists, radiologists, oncologists, oncologic surgeons. Many of the challenging patients at our institution, as well as many other institutions, are evaluated within tumor boards, where one gets instant input from numerous specialists to identify the best way to manage the patient.
I'm just curious, you know, do you think that most major tertiary cancer centers have this kind of team, or is it unusual?
I think majority of cancer centers or tertiary centers that do have cancer center status or aspirations are going this way. It is becoming very clear to all of us that treatments are these days blurring boundaries between specialties, as they are blurring boundaries between diseases, and requires really a multi-specialist approach to adequately treat the patient.
But I mean, for example, you know, I don't know, for some reason I was just, melanoma obviously is one thing, but in terms of, for example, places that would have trials, for example, like the hedgehog trials, is that something that hundreds of people, it's out in the community or just a few centers? I was kind of thinking a little bit about T-cell lymphoma and how they, you know, strategize. How many different places do you think kind of are research centers like that?
Again, it depends on whether we're talking about basal cell carcinoma, squamous cell carcinoma, and so on. Squamous cell carcinoma has been more intensively approached in centers where there is substantial transplant population and where more of the aggressive disease is seen rather than in potentially even tertiary centers where there is little of that going on, little immunosuppression. Basal cell carcinoma, again, it's something that majority of us see in large numbers, although not the advanced disease. In terms of melanoma, again, I think it's becoming a practice at most tertiary centers to actually evaluate patients in tumor board setting.